I'd like to believe that dying is like waking up from a dream. The world that felt so real just moments ago fades into nothing, and you instantly accept this new reality as if the previous one didn't matter at all. Anonymous. If there's one thing that each and every one of us has in common, it is the fact that one day this life, as we know it, will cease to exist. This can be a difficult concept to grasp. As a friend once said to me, it's the leaving that's the hardest part. Death has always been a prominent focus of the human species, as it is as much a mystery as it is a certainty. Many a billionaire have tasked themselves with being the first to overturn this fate, either by uploading human consciousness to a computer or by harnessing the powers of extraterrestrials. But in the end, no creature has cracked the code on mortality, except for maybe the Turnitopsis dornei, also known as the immortal jellyfish. But perhaps the jellyfish's experience isn't all that different from ours when we pass, floating in a dark, endless abyss until a monster comes along to gobble us up. Fortunately for human beings, with the advancements of modern science, people have been brought back from the dead. They have traveled beyond the third dimension and returned to tell us what they saw or experienced. Sometimes their stories bring us comfort, an endless supply of extra-celestial love that surrounds us with warmth and acceptance. But other times, they return to us, horrified at what awaited them just outside the realm of the living. And then there are those who are asking a much different question. What if we never die at all? What if death is merely a loading screen, and each playthrough is an opportunity to pick a different class, acquire new items, and unlock an alternate ending? Prepare yourselves, dear listener, as this week's Spectral Voyager embarks on a journey through the afterlife. Behind the cracking wallpaper of our reality, there exists another world that science has yet to explain. In here dwell monsters and madness, and potentially the answers to our most important questions. In this world, gravity intensifies, time slows down, and your heart rate quickens. I'm Jake Rokitansky.
And I'm Brad Abrahams.
And you're listening to The Spectral Voyager.
I don't know about you, Jake, but I'm afraid of death. I've had perilously close brushes to it a few times, but the fear remains. I was raised mostly as an atheist, with the belief that when we go, everything goes out like a light. And maybe that's where the anxiety about it comes from. I think when I boil it down, it's my consciousness that I'm afraid of losing. Perhaps that means I'm attached to my own ego. And though my esoteric pursuits are wide, for some reason, I've never looked too deeply into where we go after the light goes out. So when you suggested this episode, I thought, why not throw myself at its two most controversial pillars, near-death experiences and reincarnation? In particular, I think these two fields stretch credulity so much because they challenge a belief at the core of biology, that the mind and consciousness are not just products of the brain, but somehow, more. These subjects are a minefield, with extremes ranging from what I saw at the Conscious Life Expo in January, people talking of 5D immortal awakenings and extraterrestrial past life regressions, to completely legitimate, institutionally sanctioned scientific research. This sphere is so woo-filled and derided by skeptics, I wanted to find researchers with credentials longer than a giant squid's tentacles. What I found surpassed my expectations, and it's an armchair parapsychologist's wet dream, the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia's School of Medicine. Here's a clip from their website.
The Division of Perceptual Studies in the School of Medicine at the University of Virginia. We are a group of psychiatrists, psychologists, and neurobehavioral scientists who explore phenomena of consciousness.
For more than 50 years, we bring a rigorous scientific methodology to bear on the study of near-death experiences, altered states of consciousness, very young children who remember their past lives, and related phenomena that bear on the question of the relationship between the mind and the physical brain.
Yeah, so pretty cool, huh? That it's like a whole...
Yeah. Seems legit. Very professional video. Mm-hmm. Very serious looking people. I don't notice any cranks in this video thus far.
The division was founded by Dr. Ian Stevenson in 1957. He graduated from the top of his med school at McGill, became a pioneer in psychosomatic medicine, and went on to publish over 70 extensively cited papers. Intrigued by reports about children in India who reported past lives, he unexpectedly veered into the world of reincarnation research. He brought his meticulous ethic to collecting cases from around the world, garnering respect from unlikely places like the Journal of the American Medical Association and the American Journal of Psychiatry. One renowned psychiatrist said of him,
"He's a methodical, careful, even cautious investigator whose personality is on the obsessive side. Either he is making a colossal mistake or he will be known as the Galileo of the 20th century." That's every scientist, though, right? That's you're either a huge mistake or you're Albert Einstein.
The two voices you hear in the video are his predecessors, Dr. Jim Tucker, who researches children who remember past lives, and Dr. Bruce Grayson, who focuses on near-death experiences. Both are respected and experienced professors of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at the university. Surprisingly, for researchers pursuing these fringe subjects, I could find no controversial dirt or substantial criticisms about them or their methodology. They're almost boring in a way, which I think is the hallmark of a good scientist. Together, they've amassed around 8,000 case studies in their respective fields.
Wow.
The first we'll float towards the light to is reincarnation, which previously held very little interest for me. That was about to change.
Entering the flesh again. As, after casting away worn-out garments, a man later takes new ones, so, after casting away worn-out bodies, the embodied self encounters other new ones. The Bhagavad Gita.
Although the belief in reincarnation isn't common here in the USA, I was surprised to learn that globally, we're in the minority. The concept of soul rebirth, or as the ancient Greeks called it, metempsychosis, is foundational in Indian religions like Hinduism, and across South and East Asia in Buddhism and Taoism. Less known, it also appears in some Jewish beliefs, as in the Kabbalistic concept of Gilgul Neshamat, as well as in indigenous cultures worldwide. Closer to our more cursed modern times, names like William James, Carl Jung, and Annie Besant entered the reincarnation discourse. Even Scientology posits that in the human is an immortal spiritual entity, a thetan, that slowly degrades through past life experiences. Only Tom Cruise and David Miscavige have fully realized their true thetan selves. Our guide into this eternal world is Dr. Jim Tucker, who's dedicated the last 40 years of his life to researching children who seem to remember past lives. A child psychologist by trade, he navigates the stormy waters of past lives with a discerning, skeptical, unreligious, yet open mind. And the fruits of his research have led him to a very unlikely conclusion. Reincarnation seems to be the most compelling explanation for the strongest of cases he's encountered. Before we get to the stories, here are some trends that Tucker's 3,000 cases pointed to.
Most children start sharing their past life stories between ages 2 to 4, usually ceasing by 6 or 7, and then leading ordinary lives.
There's an average time interval of 15 to 16 months between the previous personality's death and their birth.
A staggering 75% of cases involve sudden, violent, or unnatural deaths in the previous lives, suggesting a potential link between traumatic endings and reincarnation memories.
In 70% of the cases where the circumstance of death is known, the children display intense fears and phobias related to the mode of death, particularly when the death was a drowning.
The majority of children claim to have lived in the same country, village, or family in their past life.
When the children meet the previous personality's family, they often find relief and better integration of their past life memories.
While unusual desires for alcohol or tobacco aligned with the previous personality are rare, they are present in some cases. We're talking two-year-olds demanding ciggies and booze. Wow. I mean, to me, that's the most damning evidence right there. You wake up in a new body, you're like, oh man, give me a ciggy.
And then we have to talk about the birthmarks. Wildly, in a surprising number of cases, children claiming past lives are born with distinctive birthmarks or birth defects that align with the fatal wounds of the person they say they were.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Stay with me. These birthmarks are usually prominent, varying in size and shape, and sometimes even replicate bullet entry and exit wounds. When available, autopsy reports or medical records seem to substantiate the wounds. In India, 33% of claimed reincarnation cases present these physical anomalies, with 18% backed by medical documentation. But Jim Tucker notes these need more meticulous examination. One example is Suleiman Kaper from Turkey, whose mother had a strange dream during her pregnancy. In it, a man she didn't recognize told her,
"I was killed with a blow from a shovel. I want to stay with you and not anyone else.
Upon birth, her son had a depressed skull and corresponding birthmark. He later identified himself as a granary worker killed by a shovel blow, of which the details have now been verified. Before taking you through our featured case, I wanted to share a few other morsels. First is Kumkum Verma, a young girl from Bihar, India. At age 3, she began recalling vivid details of a past life, living in a city 25 miles away. She said her name was Sundari, and she was a blacksmith's wife. She recounted details like her neighborhood, family members' names, her house's layout, and that there was a pond outside. There were specific details too, like the location of an iron safe in her house, and that she hung a sword over the cot that she slept in. She even weirdly talked about a pet snake she fed milk to. These accounts were meticulously noted down by an aunt before any attempt to verify the information was made. Once investigated, it turned out that indeed, there was a Sundari who was married to a blacksmith in the town Kumkum claimed. And miraculously, all of the other details matched Sundari's life, right down to the milk-fed snake. The investigation unearthed no prior connection between the two families, and because Kumkum's family was of a wealthy class, her father was not happy about his daughter's connection to the life of a blacksmith's wife and tried to suppress it.
That's wild.
Yeah, yeah. So this was like the first one that I read about and was like, huh, okay.
I mean, yeah, how do you, what rational explanation is there for something like this?
Yeah, so we'll go through all of this the kind of skeptical arguments against this later.
Yeah, I'm really curious to hear that.
Yeah. Now moving to Lebanon, I found the baffling story of Suzanne Ghanem. At just under 1 year old, her first words were, remarkably,
"Hello, Layla,"
which she would repeatedly speak into a telephone. As she grew, she unveiled to her mom a past life narrative. She gave her own first name as Sada, and when asked for her last name, she said,
"My head is still small. Wait until it is bigger, and I might tell you."
And indeed, when she was 2, she did, giving the last name Hatoum. She spoke of her previous life's death in the USA during a heart surgery and described her intense longing to reunite with her daughter, Layla. She started recalling intricate details, including the names of 25 people, and even remembered a full phone number. By 5 years old, her family had enough to go on to find who, if anyone, she was talking about. And then they found the family of Sada Hatoum. Sada was a Lebanese native who had indeed traveled to the US for heart surgery, leaving behind a daughter named Layla. When the two families finally met in person, which included Sada's widowed husband, Halim, most of Suzanne's claims turned out to be correct and were enough to convince Sada's family that she was her reincarnation. In total, Suzanne's mother recorded 54 statements her daughter made before they found Sada's family. 43 were verified as true. Just some of them include,
"She lived in a city named Far Salwan.
The house in Far Salwan had to be reached by stairs and had a metal frame with grapes in front of it.
Her husband was named Halim and could not drive a car.
She had a brother named Aflaton who was a doctor and treated people in a place near the Druze temple.
She had a brother named Pythagor who was also a doctor.
And she had a brother named Farez who was an agricultural engineer and had a wife named Ida.
Sada's neighbor Nadia would sit with her daily when she was sick.
Sada had heart disease.
She was operated on but died at the age of about 40 years.
And she was able to immediately pick out and identify relatives in a photo album."
That is wild.
Yeah. Suzanne also had an unhealthy fixation on Sada's widower, Halim, including calling him up to 3 times a day and becoming inconsolable when he remarried. That's just got to be so awkward, like you have a 5-year-old that's in love with you.
Yeah, that keeps calling and is upset that you've remarried. That has got to be, that is a very bizarre kind of baggage to have.
Our penultimate case is a more fun one. Ryan Hammonds was born in 2004 in Muskogee, Oklahoma. Like Suzanne and Kumkum, claims of his past life were also documented well before anyone could identify the previous person he was said to be. Ryan's parents, Cindy and Kevin, devout Protestant Christians, were confused when their son began speaking in complete sentences and immediately started sharing vivid memories of a past life as an actor and agent in Hollywood. And there's the son and the mom there.
Yeah, look like normal people.
Normal Oklahomans?
Yeah.
Ryan recounted tales of 3 adopted sons, a luxurious house with a pool on a street with the name Rock in it, a beloved green car, and a life filled with beaches, girlfriends, and an acute distaste for Roosevelt. His most intense period of memories occurred at 4, continuing sporadically for years, especially during bath time. And this was something common, was kids would usually talk about these memories when they were relaxed. And so it would come just, you know, in quiet moments usually.
Interesting.
Yeah. He would also have nightmares where he'd clutch his chest and say he couldn't breathe, He'd sometimes get unbearably sad, longing for his previous life and family. Cindy, desperate to help her son, started showing him picture books from old Hollywood. One photo in particular had him jump out of his seat. It was a film still from the 1932 movie Night After Night. He pointed to a man in a fedora and said, "That's me, Mommy." And there's the photo.
Yeah, a classic-looking actor, big top hat, stogie hanging out of his mouth, brooding expression.
Have you seen this movie or heard of it?
No, I haven't. But this is somebody that any kid would want to be. I mean, sure. He looks really cool.
The problem was, this actor had a non-speaking role and seemed to be uncredited. An extensive investigation led by Jim Tucker eventually led to him being identified as an obscure entertainer named Marty Martin. Also a classic
fake name.
Cindy, who was fortunately journaling all of Ryan's statements, wrote down about 230 items. And when Jim Tucker and Ryan's family tracked down one of Marty's daughters, they finally got some validation. Here's Marty's daughter verifying a handful of them, visibly shaken and emotional while reading them.
Dr. Tucker contacted me, and he was showing me all the details that Ryan had about my father. And the ones that struck me were that he was an agent. He ran an agency, which is true. And then it was agency changed people's names, which they did. And he had mentioned that he lived on a street that had rocks in it. And the name of his street was Roxbury Drive. That he had a large swimming pool. And then his mother had curly hair. He also claims that my father had a green car. I didn't know that. And I said no. And it turns out that he did have a green car. And that my father, Marty, had many wives, which is true. That he tap danced, correct. And that the stage was in New York City. He ate in Chinatown a lot. And he had a favorite restaurant there. Well, there was a favorite restaurant of his called Ofong's. And he also claimed that Marty had a younger sister, which I didn't know, which I said was wrong and which he turned out to be correct. Oh, and then he bought his daughter, which is me, a dog when she was about six. And it's true, I did not like the dog.
Ryan said he was 61 when he died. Now, Marty Martin's death certificate said that he was 59. I looked into it and found three census records, two marriage listings, and a passenger list that all gave ages that meant Marty Martin was 61 when he died. So Ryan was correct. Between records that we could obtain, we were eventually able to verify over 50 of Ryan's statements fit with Marty Martin's life.
Of course, leave it to Hollywood. Of course, he lied and said he was 2 years younger to everybody else. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I love that case, especially just because it was, you know, it's one thing if it's like, oh, I was, you know, Humphrey Bogart in a past life. But no, it was this incredibly obscure, like uncredited guy.
Yeah, that's wild. I can't think of, usually when we do these episodes, I can sort of think of a rational explanation to explain this, like, oh, it was, oh, they lived in the same town and he saw pictures of the guy in the, you know, in the barber shop or whatever. Who knows?
Little man can't get out.
I've saved the best and eeriest for last. It's the most well-known case, but worth retelling because of just how enigmatic it is. Born to Bruce and Andrea Leninger in 1998, James Leninger was a lively and happy child. A visit to an aviation museum at age two sparked an early obsession with World War II era planes. Though for him, it seemed to be more than an ordinary childhood fascination. Soon after the visit, he corrected his mother's identification of a toy plane's drop tank, as well as other references to obscure aviation terms and maneuvers. He single-mindedly played with a toy airplane he'd been gifted, repeatedly nosediving it into the coffee table, as evidenced by all the dents and scratches. With each nosedive, he would repeat,
"Airplane crash on fire."
Whenever his dad would leave on a business trip, James's goodbye at the airport was always a disconcerting,
"Daddy, airplane crash on fire."
Imagine your son saying that to you every time you leave.
I would, they would have to be put in timeout for that. That's something I could, as a person with anxiety, that is a behavior that I could not stand for.
Shortly after, the nightmares began. Here's his mother's recollection.
He was laying on his back and he was kicking his feet up like this and pounding his fists like this, just kicking and screaming at the top of his lungs. Then the next night he had another one. And it was the exact same thing, the same exact kicking motion. And the more he had it, the more bizarre it became because it was so specific and so repetitive.
This went on for like 3-4 months, something like that. And then one night he had another night terror. And all of a sudden, I heard what he was saying. It suddenly, I'm not sure what happened, but it clicked in my head. And he was saying, airplane crash on fire. Little man can't get out. Still gives me goosebumps.
Damn.
Yeah. One day, while the three of them were sitting on a couch, James started to pantomime his dreams, saying,
"The little man is going like this,"
while kicking his hands and feet up in the air. Andrea asked him who the little man was, and James replied,
"Me."
Trying to get more info, she asked for the little man's name. He said,
"James."
Thinking he was confusing himself with the little man, she asked if he had any friends or was with anyone. He immediately replied with a name neither her nor her husband were familiar with.
"Jack Larson."
As his vocabulary grew, he was better able to articulate what he was feeling.
So one day I was in the kitchen, I was washing dishes, James had breakfast, and he had an airplane, he was just flying around like this, and he goes, "Mama, before I was born, I was a pilot, and my airplane got shot in the engine and crashed in the water, and that's how I died." And I was just froze. It was such a bizarre thing to say, but it was just that matter of fact. There was no drama, there was no emotion to it.
Just out of curiosity, I said, "Well, who shot your plane down?" He said, "The Japanese." I said, "How did you know it was the Japanese?" He said, "The big red sun." I said, "Well, where did your plane come from?" He said, "A boat." So I said, "Did your boat have a name?" And he said, "Natoma." I said, "That sounds Japanese to me." And he looked at me like I had no brain. He said, "No, it's an American." And he was upset.
Still baffled by what their son was going on about, his folks finally had some details to look into. The name Jack Larson, the Japanese, and the ship named Natoma Bay. The fourth key puzzle piece came when Bruce picked up a book about Iwo Jima, hoping to find some clues. As he was flipping through it, he stopped on a page that was a map of Iwo Jima. James pointed excitedly.
"That's where my plane got shot down."
Bruce immediately searched online for the terms Iwo Jima and Natoma Bay. And indeed, the Natoma, by no means a well-known ship, was at the Battle of Iwo Jima. And there's a photo of the ship there.
Oh, sure. Sure as hell. Sure as hell, that's a ship.
What he found next freaked him out even more. He found the ship's logbook, and to his shock, the armaments officer was one Jack Larson. Here's Bruce's reaction.
I was just in shock. Just the hairs went up on my neck. Because my son had an hour earlier gave me the name of this ship out of the ether. I said, "Oh man, what the hell is happening? How could he know this?" I was not just skeptical, I was adamant that this was not happening in my house. And my belief system rebelled against the concept and the idea of reincarnation and past lives.
He's like, "I had no other option than to think that my little boy was possessed by a demon."
I think that is, you know, initially what they might have thought because he was, you know, somewhat religious. During this time, James would draw the same scene over and over again. It was a battle over water, with the plane being hit in the engine in flames. He always signed these pictures James 3. Understandably, you'd think this meant he was putting his age beside his name, but he insisted it was because he was the third James, and the signed number 3 persisted even when he turned 4 and 5. Here's some of those photos. He made like, you know, 100 of these.
Wow. So maybe I was Cunt Dracula in a past life. Or a Ninja Turtle or a Ghostbuster.
Yeah. Hopefully not Dead Bart S, though.
No, definitely not. Definitely not him.
When Bruce decided to go to a Natoma Bay reunion, he found something out that seemed to change everything. There was only one man killed on the Natoma Bay at Iwo Jima. His name was James Houston Jr. The name alone would be bizarre enough of a coincidence, but the fact that he was a James Jr. would make James Leninger the third James, hence James 3.
Whoa, wait, explain. So who was the first James?
His dad, James Houston's dad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Wild, but it gets more beyond belief. During this time, James was gifted a few G.I. Joe figurines, whom he promptly named Billy, Walter, and Leon. His parents were curious why he chose those specific names, and James said it's because that's who he met in the space between lives. Bruce and Andrea later learned that James Houston had three squad mates that had been killed prior to his own death. Billy Peeler, Walter Devlin, and Leon Connor. Their hair colors even matched those of the G.I. Joes he'd assigned them.
Oh, come on.
I know. Yeah, it's insane, right? So the story would be easier to pick apart if it was all told retroactively. But it unfolded over time, with all of James's statements being recorded, and sometimes even on television, before the identity of James Houston had ever been found and verified. Here's Dr. Tucker with the roll call of all of James's correct statements.
James said that he flew off the Natoma. Houston was a pilot on the USS Natoma Bay. James said he flew a Corsair. Houston had flown a Corsair. He was actually flying a different plane when he was killed, but he was part of the squadron that had tested the Corsair for the Navy. James said he was shot down by the Japanese, and Houston was shot down by the Japanese. James said he died at Iwo Jima. Houston was the one Natoma Bay pilot killed during the Iwo Jima operation. James said one day, quote, "My airplane got shot in the engine and crashed in the water, and that's how I died." Eyewitnesses reported that Houston's plane was, quote, hit head-on right on the middle of the engine. James had nightmares of a plane crashing and sinking in the water. Houston's plane crashed in the water and quickly sank. And James said that Jack Larson was there, and Jack Larson was the pilot of the plane next to Houston's on the day that he was killed.
Oh, my God. I just feel like I reached the end of The Sixth Sense. Okay, so he said Jack Houston initially because his parents said, do you have any friends or is there anybody there with you? And he went, Jack.
Jack Larson, yeah.
That's where the Jack Larson comes from.
Yep.
So, and they didn't understand because they said, who are you? And he said, James. And that confused them because that was his name. Okay, exactly. It all makes sense to me. And now is even crazier and scarier and weird.
Yeah, and you know, any of those, like even, you know, two of those kind of in isolation could be a coincidence that just like a kid with a little bit of knowledge of World War II or aviation could come up with, but all of
maybe them, they could come up with that we were fighting the Japanese and maybe they could come up with it was off an aircraft carrier, but naming the three squad mates who had previously passed as well as the pilot who was with him in his own plane crash is pretty unexplainable.
Yeah, especially like this was a pretty unknown guy. Like it took them years of research to find that name. And even the Natoma wasn't like, that's not a ship that I think most people could pull out of the ether.
The only rational explanation that I could come up with really is that this is a get rich quick scheme. The father is a World War II sort of armchair expert and coaches his son to go on TV and file these reports and make these statements. That's the only way this happened. I don't think something like this happens by accident, right?
What do you mean by accident?
Well, just that he sort of is just speaking childish gibberish, it somehow lines up with these very, very specific details.
Yeah, it would be one heck of a coincidence. And so,
coincidence.
You know, the cynical view would be, yes, you know, in a lot of these cases, the parents are like coaching the children, but they were fairly extensively investigated over years. With this family, it was multiple investigators. And the fact that it unfolded over time kind of lays more credence to it. And you know, like I'm by no means like totally bought in on it.
Yeah. But I could see, yes, if, a couple factors here, right? Oftentimes we misremember what people say, you know, we misremember what people say. There's also, you know, it could have been they said something kind of gibberish and we wanted to find meaning in it. And then thereby we started showing the child books and images and stuff. Yeah. And then the story sort of takes off from there. And, you know, they don't remember that they introduced the material at the same time as he's telling the story. They misremember and maybe think something came before as opposed to after or during when the child is exposed to, these historical details. That sort of thing. I mean, I could see something there in some sort of weird symbiosis of like pillidness and suggestion and misremembering. But again, like you said, I mean, that is a pretty, it's pretty tremendous to have taken place over a long period of time. And it's not like they got rich off this, right?
No. And also just like, it was like incredibly stressful for the kid. It was causing him duress. All of their extended family members were, you know, involved at some point. So it'd be a pretty big collusion. Yeah. But so there's a trove of other perplexing details from the story, but I just encourage people to read more about it, which include the skeptical arguments against it and Dr. Tucker's rebuttal of those. Instead, I'll leave you with the moment when James's parents took him to where the plane went down near Chichijima and Iwo Jima, with the hopes that it would help him let go and focus on being himself again. Here he is reflecting later in life.
Closure is the one word I can really use to describe it. My mom said it's time to say goodbye to James Houston, and I just released something. And then as soon as we got back on shore, it just stopped crying. I don't know if it was stress, but just relieved a weight that had been looming over me for the entirety of my youth up until that point.
The spirit that I used to have when I was 4, 5, 6 has gone away. I'm just James now. It's not, I still have James Houston in me, I think, but it's not so much the bad history. It's more of the peaceful history of his life.
God damn, can you imagine? Like, be like with all of the other difficult things that you have to deal with,
as
you
a
know,
kid, yeah.
as a kid, that you are grappling with the idea that the soul of somebody else is a part of you.
Yeah.
That's really, really tough to grapple with, I think. You know, especially because as a kid, you're constantly struggling with your own identity and who you are and where you fit into the world. And to have, you know, in James's case, these very historical, well-documented account of who you might have been. I mean, this is a lot different than, you know, somebody at a party having, mm-hmm. you know, too many glasses of wine and saying, like, I think in a past life I was a glorious warrior on mm-hmm. a battlefield. You know, it's totally, totally different. And yeah, I mean, I can understand and see how upsetting that would be to parents and a kid, especially if you are living, if you are reliving over and over every time you close your eyes or go to sleep or, you know, you're in a quiet room, you know, this sort of traumatic death. I mean, yikes, that's really terrifying.
Yeah, I think especially for like American children, because you know, in India or like Southeast Asia, where it's a more common belief, there, you know, be less stigma about it. And maybe, you know, children are taught about it as part of their religion and have some kind of a framework to deal with it. But for a kid who's never heard of reincarnation before, or a whole family that hasn't, it's pretty traumatizing. And yeah. he was like, when Dr. Tucker came to assess and investigate, he was like, this kid, he has all the signs of like PTSD, except he never faced any actual trauma at home. Yeah. This PTSD is coming from somewhere else.
Wow.
So understandably, investigations into past lives have stoked the fires of controversy and have gotten some valid skepticism. Chief among them is that the existence of reincarnation hinges on the lack of a materialist explanation for consciousness surviving death. But without resorting to quantum woo, of which not even Jim Tucker can help himself, this shouldn't stop science from studying the phenomena. Though there are more prosaic and reasonable criticisms of this kind of anecdotal evidence, like fraud, fantasy, coincidence, and knowledge being acquired through conventional means, such as the children overhearing anecdotes from others. Tucker picks these off one by one. Fraud seems implausible given the lack of benefits for the family, as well as the necessity for widespread collusion, including that of a network of professional researchers. These families or individuals are often faced with ridicule and unwanted attention. And in some of the most compelling Asian cases, the past lives were of a much lower caste or social status, so there's no financial incentive. The idea that it's all fantasy falls short as soon as these children divulge intricate, verifiable, and consistent details of these past lives. Similarly, coincidence seems reasonable at first, but crumbles with cases like Suzanne's, where she identified 20-plus people from her previous life, or Ryan's, getting scores of obscure details correct. Knowledge acquired through normal means is also unlikely when children possess information about deceased individuals they or their family has never met or heard of. And lastly, there's faulty memory, where the parents are simply misremembering, which is admittedly likely in a handful of cases. But the sheer volume of Tucker's cases that feature consistent and verifiable details tips the scales here towards something more enigmatic, at least I think. In his book, The Demon-Haunted World, the skeptical Carl Sagan took down many a New Age and paranormal claim. But when it came to reincarnation, he said this in his hypnotic, dulcet tones.
At the time of writing, there are three claims in the parapsychology field which, in my opinion, deserve serious study, with the third being that young children sometimes report details of a previous life, which upon checking, turn out to be accurate, and which they could not have known about in any other way than reincarnation. I pick this claim not because I think it's likely to be valid, I don't, but as examples of contentions that might be true. Of course, I could be wrong.
Now, let's break the cycle of samsara and peer over the event horizon into the real beyond.
Expérience de mort imminente.
Near-death experiences, or NDEs, are profoundly personal events that happen at the brink of death, often when people are pronounced clinically dead. They describe going through distinct stages, first having a heightened sense of awareness, then feeling peace and detachment from pain, to having out-of-body experiences and ascending through a tunnel towards a light, to meeting deceased loved ones and experiencing a life review. Experiencers describe feelings of serenity, joy, and warmth, and are nearly universally positive about it. They are more common than you think, with 1 in 20 Americans having had one.
That was surprising for me to read.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And so here's a Hieronymus Bosch painting called Ascent of the Blessed that some people think is a reference to a near-death experience.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Naked bodies being carried towards a tunnel filled with light by winged creatures. I mean, some of these don't necessarily look like angels. They look like they could take you, you know, either way.
Most of my research and the tales you're about to hear come from Dr. Bruce Grayson at DOPPS. As mentioned before, he's a professor emeritus of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at the University of Virginia and has been involved in the science of NDEs for over 40 years. He created the Grayson Scale, a tool for measuring NDEs that's since been cited in publications over 450 times. It's safe to say he's an expert, with Encyclopedia Britannica hiring him to write their entry on NDEs. He was also the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Near-Death Studies for 25 years. Straight out of med school, while interning as an emergency hospital psychiatrist, he had an experience with a patient who, despite being comatose after a suicide attempt, accurately described a private conversation he had outside her room. Her detailed retelling of the conversation, down to Grayson's attire and a fresh pasta sauce stain on his tie, challenged his conventional understanding of consciousness and the mind-brain relationship.
Wow, so let this be a note to all of you doctors and surgeons out there. Don't shit talk the patient when they are under anesthesia in the operating room, okay? They might hear you. They might tell you that your shirt looks like shit and you've got spaghetti sauce all over it.
After researching 4,000 cases collected over decades, Bruce has made some puzzling discoveries that show these experiences are not just freak medical quirks. One is the enigma of an increased and even hyper-alertness in NDEers, despite no brain activity or oxygen to the brain. In one study, experiencers had a 97.6 accuracy rate in recalling resuscitation procedures when they shouldn't have been aware of anything at all. When the control group in the study, who did not report NDEs, were asked to imagine what their resuscitations looked like, their descriptions were vague and full of mistakes. Some were even able to describe odd details from their operations. Al Sullivan, while unconscious for coronary bypass surgery, reported floating up to the top of the room and saw his surgeon flapping his elbows like a chicken. When confronted about it later, the flabbergasted surgeon confirmed that this was his own quirky post-scrub-down ritual. 95% of experiencers affirm that their NDEs were real and have had a profound impact on their personality and life outlook post-experience. Despite not becoming more religious, many express heightened spirituality, empathy, and a diminished fear of death. More than 80% of NDEers report out-of-body experiences. Armed with this crash course, I'm going to take you through the classic stages of the NDE by way of people's touching, personal anecdotes. One of the universal features is the feeling of time dilation, how just a few seconds or minutes can feel like an eternity. For this, we have the case of Albert von St. Gallenheim. Heim was a Swiss geology professor who, in 1892, published the first collection of near-death experiences. When he was 22 years old, he had a mountain climbing accident that sent him plummeting 66 feet, crashing and careening against rock faces along the way. To his shock, the experience, as it happened, was beautiful.
What I felt in 5 to 10 seconds could not be described in 10 times that length of time. All my thoughts and ideas were coherent and very clear, and in no way susceptible, as are dreams, to obliteration. First of all, I took on the possibilities of my fate and said to myself, the crag point over which I will soon be thrown evidently falls off below me as a steep wall. It matters a great deal whether or not snow is still lying at the base of the cliff wall. If this is the case, the snow will have melted from the wall and formed a border around the base. If I fall on the snow, I may come out of this with my life. But if there is no more snow down there, I am certain to fall on rubble, and at this velocity, death will be quite inevitable. If, when I strike, I am not dead or unconscious, I must instantly seize my flask of spirits and put some drops from it on my tongue. I thought of taking off my glasses and throwing them away so that splinters from them might not injure my eyes, but I was so thrown and swung about that I could not muster the power to move my hands for this purpose. A set of thoughts and ideas then ensued concerning those left behind. My next thought was that I would not be able to give my beginning university lecture that had been announced for 5 days later. I considered how the news of my death would arrive for my loved ones, and I consoled them in my thoughts. Objective observations, thoughts, and subjective feelings were simultaneous. Then I heard a dull thud, and my fall was over.
So all of that, what Haim recounts, was like over 3 to 5 seconds, basically, of falling.
Yeah.
So Haim found many other similar accounts from climbers who had fallen, as well as soldiers who were injured, near drownings, and other accidents, and compiled them into that 1892 publication. He would often talk about his NDE and its peculiar effect on the relativity of space-time to his students at Zurich's Polytechnic Institute. And guess who was one of his students, Jake?
I can read the doc, but this is incredibly surprising.
Yeah, it was a teenage Albert Einstein. And so it's like total conjecture that that's where he started to think about relativity of space-time, but it's interesting.
Yeah, hey, yeah. Interesting to say the least.
For the out-of-body experience, we have Bill, who was firefighting the burning wreckage of an airplane at an Air Force base in 1970. At one point, the plane exploded, knocking him backwards.
I felt a lifting sensation and saw two of my buddies carrying one of the unconscious firefighters away. Somehow I knew who the helpers were, even though they were wearing aluminized suits with hoods on, but I didn't know who they were dragging. I yelled out, "Hey, Dan, Jim, help me!" But they couldn't hear me. Then I realized that because I was the only fireman in that position, and also because my pain, taste, and smell were gone, that must be my body they were dragging away. I could see everything much more clearly and felt warm, safe, and peaceful. I was in darkness, but fully conscious and vividly aware of my surroundings. I was in some kind of tunnel that looked like what a tornado funnel would be from the inside. There was a light in the distance, and I saw the spiraling strings of blue-green light coming and going like the Aurora Borealis. The light was drawing me to it. I moved exceptionally fast down the tunnel, and it took no time at all to reach it. It seemed that time was different or non-existent there, or wherever there was.
Bill encountered a being of light there, who proceeded to show him a review of every single event from his life, from childhood all the way to the plane wreckage. And with each, asking him how he felt about that event and how he treated the other people during them. Most of these were events he had completely forgotten about and often was not proud of. But he was forgiven and told it was time to go back.
I was back in my body again. I do not remember traveling there. The pain was back and I smelled the odor of jet fuel and heard sirens and explosions. The doctors and medics were busy with Dan and Jim, but not noticing me. Later, I found out that they looked at me long enough to see that I was dead and turned their attention to those that they could help. 2 days later, the doctor told me that I was lucky that I didn't die. I said that I did die. He looked at me in a strange way and scheduled me for psychological evaluations. I learned to keep my mouth shut about the incident from that time on.
More on the theme of the life review, there's the experience of famed British Rear Admiral Sir Francis Beaufort. In 1791, when he was just 17, he fell off a boat into Portsmouth Harbor. Unfortunately, he had not yet learned to swim and exhausted himself thrashing in the water while trying to gulp breaths of air. As his consciousness slipped away, a strange calmness overtook him.
From the moment that all exertion ceased, which I imagine was the immediate consequence of complete suffocation, a calm feeling of the most perfect tranquility superseded the previous tumultuous sensations. It might be called apathy, certainly not resignation. Though the senses were thus deadened, not so the mind, its activity seemed to be invigorated in a ratio which defies all description, for thought rose above thought with a rapidity of succession that is not only indescribable, but probably inconceivable by anyone who has not himself been in a similar situation. The course of those thoughts went from the event which had just taken place and the awkwardness that had produced it. They then took a wider range, our last cruise, a former voyage and shipwreck, my school, the progress I had made there, and the time I had misspent, and even all my boyish pursuits and adventures. Thus traveling backward, every past incident of my life seemed to glance across my recollection in retrograde succession, not, however, in mere outline, as here stated, but the picture filled up with every minute and collateral feature. In short, the whole period of my existence seemed to be placed before me in a kind of panoramic review, and each act of it seemed to be accompanied by a consciousness of right or wrong, or by some reflection on its cause or its consequences. Indeed, many trifling events which had been long forgotten then crowded into my imagination, and with the character of recent familiarity.
I once read this post on Reddit. I think it was in the paranormal subreddit, and it was this girl who, had had a near-death experience and claimed that she had gone to the afterlife. and that it was like kind of unpleasant and awkward. It really struck me that, you know, one thing she said was, you see all of these people there, but you can hear everybody's thoughts. Mm. And it's old friends and family members, and you're kind of happy to see them, but you can also hear all of their thoughts about you, and they're not always good. Huh. And everybody is kind of confused and sort of doesn't understand where they are or why they're there. And every memory that you have, and this is what reminded me of it, listening to this person's account, is that every memory was instantly accompanied by a very clear understanding of what was motivating the action at the time. And some of it is kind of ugly. And I think that's very interesting. That seems to be a sort of reoccurring kind of phenomenon within this.
Yeah.
Is the idea that, you know, from this perspective outside of time and outside of your life, you can be immediately honest with yourself about the things you said or the things you did or the way you treated people. And that always just felt kind of realistic to me in a weird way. There's something about the kind of, you know, it's more purgatory than it is anything else. Mm-hmm. And really the purgatory of having to reconcile with, you know, the decisions you made. I don't know, that feels, there's something there that feels kind of, it'd be hard to make that up, I guess.
Yeah, there's an account that I didn't include where this guy was going through a life review, and one of the events, he had beat up a drunk that had sort of like jumped in front of his car and like hurled epithets at him, and he beat this guy up really bad. And in his life review, he actually switched perspectives and was the guy that he was beating up. And he was feeling like each punch and his, you know, the shattering of his teeth. And more than that, he also learned why this guy was so angry that day. And it was because, you know, one of his children had died. And he, you know, was drowning his sorrows in whiskey. And, you know, maybe that, you know, that's possibly or probably not what really happened, but this guy either way was on the other end or the receiving end of something he was not proud of and understood this other person's perspective. These life reviews often lead to a radical change in the experiencer, as in the case of Mickey the mobster. Mickey served as the chief steward of a mafia-owned resort where he was tasked with providing celebs with sex workers and other entertainment. He treated these sex workers and anyone else he disrespected very roughly. That is, until a heart attack propelled him into a full-blown NDE. Once out on the other side, he was a different person, leaving the mob and devoting his time to helping juvenile delinquents and victims of spousal abuse. His girlfriend at the time left him because he didn't care about money or jewelry or fast cars anymore. He describes his change like this.
Before the experience, my attitude was that people have to help themselves. You know, if they don't help themselves, to hell with them. I couldn't imagine myself as any sort of helping professional before the NDE, but afterwards, I'd find myself counseling people. I'd find myself listening to people. They said, "You really listen to me, you know? You really understand how I feel inside." Before, I would say, "Listen, pal, I ain't got the time. God helps those that help themselves. So get your butt out there and help yourself, because it's war out there on the street. It's a war." The experience made me more sensitive to and aware of others' pain. I still get very teary about others who are in pain. People I know can't understand that. Sometimes I sit down and I look at myself and I say, "The hell am I doing here? I could be making 10 times this money. I used to have a big Cadillac, a luxury apartment. I needed those things. They were necessary for my identity. Now, to tell the truth, doesn't make any difference whether I make $10 a day or $10,000 a day. Doesn't matter. Doesn't mean anything. Right now, I'm up to my ears in bills. I got all kinds of bills, but it doesn't really upset me."
Yeah, pretty miraculous change there.
Which, I mean, could also be just like, hey, I almost died. You wake up, you go, do I really want to be, you know, making other people suffer and life is really precious and I you know, maybe I want to, I've been given a second chance. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a reason for this. A lot of people, you know, when they have these experiences, instead of going, "Wow, man, that was totally random, and I just really lucked out, I guess. They go like, no, I've been given a second chance, yeah. And there's meaning in this, because we have to find meaning. That's, you know, one of the things that comforts us. I mean, that's, you know, how this whole, you know, why conspiracy theories and this kind of stuff, the fact that you and me are even here in the first place is a result of, yeah. You know, people looking for explanations or something that gives them meaning, because otherwise, what, you know, what is there?
Yeah. We're going to end with the perplexing story of Pam Reynolds, a singer-songwriter who lived in Atlanta. Her experience, more than any other, seemed to point to consciousness being more than just our brain. In 1991, at the age of 35, she started to have sudden and debilitating symptoms of dizziness, loss of speech, and trouble controlling her limbs. She was diagnosed with a perilously large aneurysm in her brain and told the surgery of which had a 0% survival rate. She had just one chance, an experimental procedure at the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix. They were to medically induce a cardiac arrest. This involved lowering her body temperature from 98 to 50 Fahrenheit, which is 10 degrees Celsius, which stopped her heart, breathing, and flatlined her brain. They also drained all the blood out of her head to reduce the risk of internal hemorrhaging. Her eyes were taped shut, and earplugs with speakers were placed in her ear that emitted loud clicks to monitor her lack of brain activity. The surgery, which lasted 7 hours, had complications, including them needing to operate on an artery in her leg. During the hours when she was as clinically dead as it gets, having zero brainwave activity and no blood flowing to her brain, not only did she have a clear and vivid experience, but she bafflingly was able to recall and describe what was going on during her surgery. Here's Pam, in her own words, describing the experience, which started before getting wheeled into the operating room.
After that, nothing. Absolutely nothing. Until the sound. And the sound was unpleasant, was guttural. And I remember the top of my head tingling, and I just sort of popped out of the top of my head. And I was then looking down at the body. I knew it was my body, but I didn't care. My vantage point was sort of sitting on the doctor's shoulder. I remember the instrument in his hand. It looked like the handle to my electric toothbrush. I had assumed that they were going to open the skull with a saw, but what I saw looked a lot more like a drill than a saw. It even had little bits that were kept in this case that looked like the case that my father stored his socket wrenches in when I was a child. And I remember distinctly hearing a female voice saying,
"We have a problem. Your arteries are too small.
Try the other side."
I do remember wondering, what are they doing? Because this is brain surgery. And what had happened was they accessed the femoral arteries in order to drain the blood. And I did not understand that.
So it turns out that Pam's description of this highly specialized brain surgery tool was accurate. Furthermore, the surgeon said that's exactly how he would have expected a layperson to describe it. She also talked about seeing them operating on an artery in her leg, which confused her. This was also correct, as an unforeseen complication during the surgery necessitated them accessing her femoral artery. The surgeon was in disbelief by her recollection.
At that stage in the operation, nobody can observe here in that state. And I find it inconceivable that your normal senses, such as hearing, let alone the fact that she had clicking modules in each ear, that there was any way for her to hear those through normal auditory pathways.
But Pam's experience didn't end there.
I felt a presence. I sort of turned around to look at it, and that's when I saw the very tiny pinpoint of light. Light started to pull me. There was a physical sensation, rather like going over a hill real fast, and I went toward the light.
Once in the light, she heard the distinctive voice of her grandmother, as well as the presence of her beloved uncle, who had passed at 39. There were other beings, too, which she didn't recognize, but they felt familiar to her all the same. It was beautiful, and the longer she was there, the more she liked it. She didn't want to leave, but her uncle gently reminded her it was time to return.
My uncle was the one who brought me back down to the body. But then I got to where the body was, and I looked at the thing. And I for sure did not want to get in it because it looked pretty much like what it was, as in void of life. And he kept reasoning with me said, it's like diving into a swimming pool, just jump in. No. He pushed me. He gave me a little help there. It's taken a long time, but I think I'm ready to forgive him for that.
So, although recovery was long and arduous, Pam's experience changed her for the better, until she died of heart failure at the age of 53. The only conventional explanation given is what's called anesthesia awareness, which is the unsettling phenomena where a person remains awake and aware, but unable to move or communicate during surgery. Not only is it exceedingly rare, with just 0.1% incidence rate, but one's brain isn't flatlined during anesthesia like hers was, nor are their eyes taped shut or their ears plugged. So what the hell does all this mean? Getting deep into the science and philosophy of the phenomenon is beyond the scope of this podcast, and I personally think the experiences should speak for themselves, but let's briefly dip in. NDEs present a profound puzzle for science. People seem to be having rich mental activity under conditions that are impossible with zero brain function. And to date, no brain-based explanations alone seem to explain the phenomena. We don't just see this with NDEs, though. Examples of decreased brain activity coinciding with profound experiences also happen with terminal lucidity, which is where sufferers of advanced brain diseases like Alzheimer's suddenly have complete clarity before death. These further challenge the notion that the brain is the sole creator of consciousness. Dr. Grayson says these observations open the door to alternative perspectives, suggesting the brain might function more as a receiver or filter of consciousness, rather than its sole originator. It sounds far-fetched, but for all the incredible achievements in science and medicine, consciousness is still the final frontier. As UC Berkeley philosopher Alvin Noe bluntly put it,
after decades of concerted effort on the part of neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers, only one proposition about how the brain makes us conscious, how it gives rise to sensation, feeling, subjectivity, has emerged unchallenged. We don't have a clue.
Along those same lines, quantum physicist Nick Herbert said,
it is not that we possess bad or imperfect theories of human awareness. We simply have no such theories at all. About all we know about consciousness is that it has something to do with the head rather than the foot. This is fascinating to me. The idea, because I've never really thought about the brain this way, but that the brain isn't necessarily creating the sense of self. The sense of self comes from somewhere else, and the brain is just a radio that sort of tunes into a specific channel.
Yeah, and it's a theory that that has been talked about, I think, for some like thousands of years. But that's all it is, you know. It's like it's not very testable, and it only sort of comes up in these very extreme cases. But still,
I mean, that would make sense. If we're playing around here and getting silly, you know, okay, how do you explain the consciousness of a pilot who died in a plane crash to end up in the head of a little boy?
Exactly.
Well, if human consciousness is nothing more than radio waves looking for a receiver, essentially to, you know, for somebody to dial, you know, to tune it to the proper channel, well, then it makes sense how other consciousnesses could slide into, you know, other receivers. And we'll get even more into this in part two when we discuss quantum immortality.
But I think all of this is kind of missing the point, which are really the profound and lasting effects these experiences have on people. They undergo a metamorphosis of sorts, gaining a serene acceptance of death and a belief in an existence beyond the physical realm, one defined by peace and unity. Bruce makes the point that it can take months or years of intensive work for people to make even modest changes in their life. But NDEs seem to do it for people in a matter of seconds. Not only do they seem to nullify the fear of death, but also the fear of living. Dr. Grayson found that one doesn't need to go through the trauma of nearly dying in order to get these benefits, though, as just reading about the phenomena can give a positive bump to someone's outlook. So for our listeners, I'm hoping that applies to hearing about NDEs on a podcast, too. Now, you may remember from my intro to NDEs that they are overwhelmingly positive. In fact, 92% of these experiences feature an afterlife which seems to be filled with peace and love, some might say is heavenly. But there's the question of that other 8%, who describe going to another place. Jake?
And dear listener, we will have to leave you this week and explore the topics of hell and quantum immortality in Afterlife Part 2.
Yeah.
We are still taking submissions for your paranormal listener stories for our final episode of The Spectral Voyager. So if you've got something, you know, experienced clairvoyance, seen a ghost, you've been abducted by aliens, you have been attacked by a giant squid, write into us. You can email me at jake@QAnonAnonymous.com and... Maybe we will read your story and narrate it to some original music and stuff on the final episode of the show. So if you're thinking about reaching out, you know, you don't have to drive yourself crazy with it. I think usually, you know, anything under 800 words works. And like listener stories on QAA, you know, try to focus on the narrative, the experience, you know, what was happening to you, less than sort of what you were feeling at the time. Those tend to work better for the episodes. But yeah, I've been reading through everything that's been sent in so far. And it seems that we are not as alone as we think when it comes to keeping the possibility open for extra celestial experiences. You have been listening to The Spectral Voyager, a special mini-series brought to you by the folks at QAA. Thank you to everyone for subscribing. It allows us to keep making strange new shows like this one. And until next time, farewell from beyond the veil.